Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Niana Dehanova, and today on the program, we're speaking with Dr. Tanya Bakhmetyeva from University of Rochester, where she's Associate Professor of Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies and Associate Academic Director for the Susan B. Anthony Institute for Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies. Today, we're going to be discussing her recent book, Mother of the Church, Sofia Svechina, The Salon, and the Politics of Catholicism in 19th Century Russia and France. And Tanya, can you tell us a little bit about your scholarly background and how you first learned of Sofia Svechina and how you became interested in studying her?
Well, this interest in Sofia Svechina goes back to my time in Russia when I was a student at Moscow State University. At that time, that was in 1990s, and that time coincided with kind of disintegration of Soviet Union, collapse of the Soviet Union, where a lot of people were turning to religion in this vacuum of ideas that they suddenly found themselves in. I was a student in medieval history at that time and was fascinated with history of Catholicism, medieval Catholicism at that point. So I went to and explore what was the Catholic community in Moscow at the time. And to my great surprise, I discovered a lot of Russian Catholics. It was a small community, but very strong. And to me, it seemed like a lot of people, actually. So that's how my interest in Russian Catholicism started, because it was a kind of a perplexing thing. Russia, as you know, an Orthodox country, largely Orthodox. And to discover Catholics was a bit of a surprise. And I was forever remained curious about how they got to Russia, who these Russian Catholics were. And when I moved to the United States and started my PhD program, I was very fortunate to work with a scholar of Russian religious history, Professor Brenda Mean, who studied Russian Orthodox women. And kind of was a nice very lucky coincidence. I was interested in religious history, and she was doing religious history. And I turned to Catholicism, because this question of history and presence of Russian Catholics in Russia was kind of haunting me ever since I first encountered them.
Mm-hmm. And Russian Catholicism is certainly kind of an under-researched field, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. There were a couple of little things here and there. There is some interest in Russian Catholics, and there are a couple of articles appeared in France, because a lot of these Russian Catholics of the period that I study, which is the beginning of the 19th century, many of them ended up in France or had close links to France. So there was more interest in France. And in fact, archives where I worked, which were in the small town of Meudon, run by Jesuits who established Center for Russian Studies near Paris. And all of the Russian Catholic archives from the early 19th century were in France. But in the United States, English-speaking scholarship, there was not much done. I think there's a kind of a renewal interest in Russian Catholicism, and hopefully this book will contribute further to that, to support that interest. But yeah, it's not a very well-researched area.
And can you tell us a little bit about who was Sofia Svechina? You know, how does she fit into the history of Russian Catholicism?
So she's, and the reason why I focused on her finally, because initially my interest was to study this period, the early 19th century, and to look at the larger movement of Russian Catholicism, because there were a few fascinating people, and the movement, it's unclear how many people converted. Natalia Naryshkina, one of the contemporaries of that that time, she didn't convert to Catholicism, but she knew many of the converts. She suggested that maybe there were about 300 converts. It seems a bit of a larger number, but, you know, let's say roughly maybe 150 or, you know, in hundreds. So I was interested in writing a larger history, kind of a history of this larger movement. But one person kept coming up, and her name was Sofia Svechina, and I started digging in, and I discovered this fascinating woman who actually in her time was quite well known and a very controversial figure in Russia, in France, so adored by many people. Many biographies were published about her, and yet no one seemed to know anything about her. So I started digging in and learned more and more about her. So she was born at the end of the 18th century, 1783. Her father was the secretary of Catherine the Great, a very educated family. She lost her mother when she was very young and was kind of a very typical Russian noble woman, married young, but married a man who was much older than she was, opened a salon. But then in 1815, 1816, she developed this interest in Catholicism, went into seclusion with many books which she studied, and decided to convert to Catholicism. After that conversion, she moved to France, where kind of her life really begins, because in France in 1826, she opened a salon. This was not unusual for a foreigner. There were a lot of foreign salon hostesses in Paris at that time. But her salon became extremely popular. It was focused on Catholicism and Catholic ideas, and became a center of a liberal Catholic movement. And she became kind of a leader, one of the leaders of the liberal Catholic movement. That all Catholic intellectuals gravitated to that salon. So it all seemed really fascinating to me, and I wanted to explore her life a little bit more, and decided to, rather than focusing on the history of Catholicism, kind of a larger history of Catholicism, I would focus on her, and through her, looked at Russian Catholicism.
And just to go back a little bit to St. Petersburg, what was the Russian Catholic community in St. Petersburg like at the time that Svechina was growing up, and what impact did it have on her?
So, as I said, the community was strong, not large, and we don't know exactly what the numbers were. There was a mix of people, both French and Russians, because a lot of French immigrants found their home in Russia after the French Revolution. So this was a kind of a second wave of French immigration. There was an earlier wave where French were coming to Russia to serve as tutors and as teachers. Those were kind of adventurers. After the French Revolution, the wave of immigrants was mostly very well-educated people, nobles, and a lot of Catholic priests. These Catholic priests joined already existing community of Jesuits in Russia, because when Jesuits, Society of Jesus, Jesuits, was banned by the Pope in 1773, Catherine the Great gave them asylum in Russia, invited them to come and, you know, reestablish their society. So it's thanks to Russia and Prussia to some extent that the Jesuits survived at that time. So they also found their home there. So there was this French Catholic community. And because most noble Russians, and when we speak about Russian Catholicism, we mostly speak about Russian nobility, and mostly about court nobility, which is nobility of St. Petersburg, rural nobility, and other classes were not really interested in Catholicism. So these Russian nobles, they all spoke French. They were very much cosmopolitan in their worldview. And so they mingled and mixed with this French Catholics. But in my book, I argue that contrary to popular opinion, that is this French Catholics that then proselytized and converted Russians, I suggest that it's actually not the case. That at that time, in this period after the French Revolution, people were interested in religion. These nobles who grew up in the age of rationalism suddenly were turning to religion and were asking questions about religion. So, and while some Russian nobles converted back to Orthodoxy or kind of re-entered the Orthodox Church, turned back to their own religion, for others, that was not the most obvious choice. And through these discussions with French priests, a few other very distinguished French Catholic intellectuals, such as Joseph de Maistre, who's actually Sardinian, they discovered Catholicism and embraced it. To them, it spoke more to them, and it spoke their language. So it was a mixed community of Russians and French. And but what's interesting is that most of Russian converts were women. And in my book, you know, I tried to ask this question, why? Because conversion to Catholicism was not necessarily punished at that time, which is the beginning of the 19th century. The laws kind of that punished conversions became much more severe later. But at the turn of the century, kind of the authorities didn't really persecute people who converted to Catholicism. But nevertheless, for men, conversions to Catholicism probably would not be a good thing for their careers, but for women it was much safer. So a lot of women were converting while men kind of mostly stayed away, with some exceptions.
Mm-hmm. Actually, and you talk a lot about in your book about the gender aspect, right, as you just mentioned, of the conversion to Catholicism and how it sort of dovetails with these ideals of sentimentalist femininity that were common in the late 18th century, early 19th century with Karamzin. Can you comment a little bit about how sentimentalism entered into this process of Catholic women or Russian women converting to Catholicism?
So sentimentalism, I would say sentimentalism and romanticism were kind of movements that really converged with this interest in religion. And obviously sentimentalism and romanticism, its movements prioritize feelings and emotions, their own open expression. At that time, for example, cultivation of friendships became a very, really important thing. Loving friends, valuing them were kind of expected patterns of behavior among the elites. They were a mark of an educated, noble person. But just generally speaking about your inner life and about your spiritual life became something that people did very openly and engage into with great passion. Svechina and women in her circle were constantly writing about, kind of documenting every smallest move and of their soul. So this was all very much in fashion at the time, sharing these ideas. But also, Catholicism became a very romanticized religion, which Orthodoxy didn't have that appeal at that time. Many of these French Catholics who immigrated to Russia at the time were seen as martyrs, basically, because you know we know the executions, persecutions in France, and so these people who had to leave their country to move to Russia, they were kind of like martyrs for their faith. And that provided another appeal, was this romantic appeal of Catholic religion. So in some of these Russian women who converted to Catholicism, write it in their memoirs how they felt like first Christians persecuted. They had to do things in secret. So there was this allure of kind of romantic allure of persecuted Christianity and them resisting these persecutions and suffering for it. So that's kind of, there are several aspects of sentimentalism and romanticism that converge. This interest in the inner life and spirituality and emotions and kind of romanticized persecuted religion. Then there is also aesthetic appeal. Many of the women describe how music and you know, church services appeal to them. It's also kind of sentimental and romantic. So there's, you know, multiple forces, aesthetic, political, and personal, that are kind of all converge for them in this and create this strong appeal of Catholicism.
And in terms of Svechina's sort of larger conformity to the gender expectations of the time, you talk a little bit also in your book about the way that she performs traditional female roles such as wifehood and adoptive motherhood as a way to sort of actually facilitate her rise to power both in St. Petersburg and in Paris.
Yes, she definitely, and this is one of the arguments that I make in my book, is that her appeal is that she builds her authority, because There's an interesting paradox in her, because she appears and everybody describes her as a very quiet woman, as a very demure almost woman, who speaks in a very soft voice. And she, even in her writing, she preferred to write in pencil, because it felt like more ethereal. It wasn't permanent. Writing in pencil was like speaking in whisper, she once said in one of her memoirs. So she emerges as this very quiet, very traditional woman. And yet she has an enormous degree of authority, especially in France. People come to her and consult with her men from liberal Catholic movement, really noted French Catholic intellectuals. They come and consult with her not only on their books, but also on what to do. If they offered a position, a political position, they go to Svetchina and consult with her. So there's this apparent tension. How she seemed to be so traditional and such a demure woman, and yet so much she has so much power and authority. So one of my questions was, how does she do it? And one of the suggestions that I have in my book is that it's precisely her ability to kind of balance on this border where traditional femininity, border between traditional femininity and perhaps non-traditional femininity. So she always makes it a point to embrace all the markers of the traditional femininity. Yes, she has a husband. He's much older, so it's not clear what the physical aspect of their relationship was. And they have no children. But she adopts first daughter, whom she raises. But after her daughter marries, she kind of takes under her wing several other women. So serving kind of as a mother, fulfilling her role of motherhood. And yes, in her conversations, she always tries to present this herself as a traditional woman. And perhaps because of that, she's given authority because she's not threatening. She doesn't leave these boundaries. She performs that authority within these boundaries. And yet, paradoxically, she also escapes them, but precisely because she stays within them, if it makes any sense to you.
Mm-hmm. Actually, one thing I found really fascinating when you described the way that she had an influence, maybe depending on who you asked, right, during that time, on Russians in Paris converting to Catholicism, there was maybe a sense in which her gender was used against her, because on the one hand, she was acting as this kind of maternal Turing figure, but on the other hand, she was also painted as something of this Catholic seductress, right, who was leading Orthodox men astray.
Yes. And that was more of a Russian perception. I actually did not see it. I wish I could actually see more of it, because I was interested in how she exercised that influence and how did she do it to convert people to Catholicism. I was very interested in that aspect, but I didn't find much evidence. Russian perception was that, in fact, there is this woman who lives in Paris, and basically she leads astray all this Russians who make a mistake of visiting her, because she was very well positioned in Russian society. She knew Turgenev and Karamzin, so she was kind of well known. So Russian intellectuals who traveled to Paris often did go to her salon. So and the perception was that that's what she does. The moment they get to her salon, she starts her proselytizing work. But what we see, and that's particularly clear in the case of Ivan Gagarin, who was her distant relative, when he had a diplomatic post in Germany, in Berlin, but also in Paris. So when he visited her salon, we see, and he writes about it later on in his memoirs, that basically how he was converted in her salon was because he encountered there these brilliant Catholic intellectuals. And at first, he was just sitting in the corner and listening to them, and a lot of their conversations made sense to him. So when he comes back to her and says that he wants to convert to Catholicism, she is far from rejoicing in it. She is terrified because she knows, and this is now in the 1840s where things are changing, that laws against conversions to Catholicism are now actually applied. And if a person converts, especially a man in position of Gagarin, who comes from one of the most distinguished Russian families, has a brilliant career ahead of him. So if he converts to Catholicism, this career will be over. He will be stripped of his status, of his wealth. His family reputation will be ruined. So it's a really bad thing. So she's terrified and tried to convince him not to do it. He, however, persists and eventually converts. And when he decides that she gives up and she allows him to use the chapel in her salon for the procedure of conversion, where it had to, her friends do the ceremony. So, but we see in this episode is that she's not an active proselytizer, but she never shies away from having a conversation about religion and expressing her opinion in her soft, quiet, you know, way of speaking. But she does have opinions. She's not going to hide them, but she does not actively proselytize, and she does not actively seduce people to Catholicism as it was presented in Russia. So it's kind of an interesting, and some of her biographers do mention it, that she converts by example. She just has this strong personality. And in fact, when I'm speaking about her in such, you know, with such admiration, because I do have this admiration, when I was writing this book, one of my earlier reviewers said that, you know, there's too much admiration in this book. So I tried to tone it down a little bit. But she was this remarkable woman. Everybody speaks, she converts by example. It's just her mere presence had such effect on people that many of them thought, where did she find this this kind of calm and this happiness? And they look to Catholicism to you know, locate that source of her wisdom, of her calmness, of her remarkable presence. So yeah, it's paradoxical. She was not a proselytizer, but I think she converted a lot of people by mere her example or her life.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I'd like to expand a little bit more. So you talk about the way that conversion to Catholicism, especially among the influential members of the Russian nobility, was something that was looked upon not very positively, right, in Russia. And when Svechnikov was coming of age, there was a lot of Catholic intellectual presence in St. Petersburg. And what was it that changed that situation and actually led Svechnikov to move to Paris and start a personal career there?
So when she first develops the interest in Catholicism, Catholicism is one of many religions or kind of many of spiritual destinations for people who are looking for antidote to the French Revolution, because many of these Russian nobles who later converted to Catholicism were embraced Orthodox, and by later, I mean 1810s, 1815. So those would be that's the period where people actively kind of search for religion actively. But in the early 19th century, they're dealing with the aftermath of the French Revolution. And many of these nobles were basically children of the Enlightenment. They grew up embracing, you know, French philosophers, ideas of rationalism. And then suddenly the French Revolution happens. And many of them realize that French Revolution is a direct result of this ideas. This is essentially kind of ideas coming to fruition. And many Russian Catholics, Russian nobles, as nobles in other countries, especially in France, turn away from ideas of rationalism and start, you know, looking for something to fill this vacuum of ideas. They turn to spiritual. But in Russia, again, I think I mentioned it before, the destination of the spiritual quest is not immediately obvious. Yes, Russia is Orthodox, so it would be a natural choice for them to turn to Orthodoxy. But Orthodoxy is a religion that is associated with kind of a lower classes. Many of these Russian nobles don't even speak Russian, let alone Old Slavonic, that's the language that church services use. So the Russian clergy, even though this is the period when Russian Orthodox Church is going through a very dynamic period of renewal, regeneration, but still for many Russian nobles, Russian clergy is uneducated, lower classes, lower caste, so does not have appeal. So some convert or some turn back to Orthodoxy, but not all. Then there is a large group of people who convert to who kind of start looking into German mysticism, and Alexander the first emperor himself is really interested in it. And Catholicism is yet one of those destinations. So in 1810s, around the war with Napoleon, Catholicism is one of many options. And the government is very lenient in terms of, you know, this conversion. As people convert, it's not necessarily approved, but it's people are not persecuted. And then suddenly we see something changing. After the war with Napoleon, When Russians went to Europe and came back full of ideas about, you know, liberty and, you know, full of expectations of change, the emperor also went through change, but he became more and more kind of mystic. He had some interesting ideas about religion, about spirituality, and suddenly Catholicism becomes the option to turn to Catholicism in your search for spiritual is kind of shut down. There is a scandalous case where one of the members of the Galitzin's family converts to Catholicism. He was a student at the Jesuit college. There were several Jesuit schools where Russian nobles, children of Russian nobles, went to male children. And when he converts, this is it's used as a pretense to expel Jesuits from Russia. And that's where in the 1820s, late 1810s, early 1820s, where the atmosphere and the attitude towards Catholicism begin to change. Catholics are no longer welcomed as kind of one of the options for their spiritual quest. And then after the Decembrist revolt and when Nicholas I comes to power, that becomes even more problematic choice. Catholicism is now seen as a religion of enemies, is essentially anti-Russian, and Russian Catholics are perceived as traitors. And the laws now being applied to them was a greater persistence and severity. So there's a change. You know, first Catholics were kind of perceived as one of many spiritual options, but that shortly changed. And by 1830s, this was no longer an option.
The sort of the focal point, at least for Svechina, for these discussions of spirituality, partially in relation to Catholicism, was salon culture. So I'd like to get into a little bit about what the salon culture looked like in St. Petersburg.
So Svechina was a latecomer in the salon, but also kind of an early comer, maybe, to Russian salons. Because Russian salons, as many things in Russia, including interest in Catholicism, you know, they adopted from the West. And initially, Russian salons were a pale imitation of French salons, which, you know, were very vibrant centers for intellectual life. In Russia, they were kind of centers for social life, where people were just kind of hanging out. So Svechina didn't like that. And she was one of the few Russian saloniers who really wanted to adopt the kind of the classic model of a salon, which would be a center of intense intellectual discussions, where kind of intellectual celebrities would come and provide the center of gravitas for the salons. And in fact, she and a few other close friends of hers, their salons was recognized as some of the kind of most interesting and most intellectually rigorous salons of the 1810s, 1812. Later on, we see some salons blossom, but at this early stages, Svechina and a few others were holding salons that were really truly intellectually kind of serious and sometimes even heavy, as described again by Natalia Naryshkina, who adored Svechina, although Natalia Naryshkina never converted to Catholicism. And when she went to Svechina's salon, she thought it was a little too serious, a little too heavy in intellectual discussions. So, but that was good training ground for Svechina. When she moves to Paris, and, you know, a kind of a natural step for an active woman or an intellectually rigorous woman would be to open a salon. And after a little bit of searching and kind of period of apprenticeship, she opens her salon, and it's very natural for her to specialize in Catholicism because at that time, salons kind of specialized the salon hostess expertise, interests, and connections. For example, that could be music salons or art salons if the hostess was, you know, good in music and singing, or was, you know, into arts and good at art. So for Svechina, her field of expertise was religion, was Catholicism in particular. And when she decided to convert to Catholicism, or when she was asking herself, she went into seclusion and read a lot of books about Catholicism. So she was very well versed in history and theology, and that became her expertise. So, and that too, that salon too, when she opened it, she was somewhat dissatisfied with French salons, because the French salons had this revolving doors. People were constantly coming and going, and it was more of a social event. So she wanted to have something very serious and very, you know, where people could engage in deep discussions. And again, just like in Russia, some people, the famous literary critic Saint-Beuve, thought that that was not a salon. It was essentially a theological school that was happening there every night, because it was so deep and so serious and so kind of grave, and people were engaged in, you know, deep discussions. So yeah, there's a kind of a link. She was very consistent in the vision of the salon, and she brought it with her to Paris, and she had good training in Russia. Became quite successful when she opened it in Paris.
Okay, so we're talking about liberal Catholics, right? So liberal Catholics were quite interesting. This was a movement, and it's difficult to, because they never really defined themselves as a movement. Liberal Catholics was a later term, and it's kind of, you know, we call them liberal Catholics, and there is a lot of debate about what does it actually mean. Are they Catholic liberals? Do they believe in liberal institutions above all, or are they liberal Catholics? What does liberal Catholic? So there's a lot of debate about how to use this term and whether this is even a correct term, and people keep offering different opinions. So I'm sticking with this term just because it's kind of widely used, and I tried changing it and from liberal Catholics to Catholic liberals, it just doesn't work. So essentially, this was a group of people who were very concerned about the state of religion or state of Catholicism in France after the French Revolution, and especially in the 1830s, when, you know, the 1830s revolution, there was a lot of violence against Catholic Church. And Catholic Church was essentially perceived as the old regime institution that should be done with, as the old regime is, you know, is done with, so we should get rid of Catholicism. And Catholic Church essentially lost its cultural influence in France, and it's lost its political influence in France. And liberal Catholics were a group of people who were concerned about that, but they were also looking for ways to revitalize Catholic Church and kind of put it in sync with what was happening in modern society. That is, new political institutions were emerging, right? New parties were emerging, you know, the movement of liberalism. So Catholic Church was no longer, it was no longer possible for Catholic Church to rely on the support of the monarchy and survive because of this support, because the monarchy was essentially and that's final stages. So what would happen to Catholics after, you know, the old regime is completely dead? So liberal Catholics were suggesting that there is, in fact, no contradiction between, and Catholicism does not stand in opposition to all this new political changes and cultural changes, such as rise of science and scientific worldview. So liberal Catholics were trying to align Catholic beliefs and Catholic practices with the new world, with the modern world, and we're trying to reconcile modern world and Catholic religions. One of the founders was of liberal Catholic movement, and again, they were not called that. And that time was Félicité Lamennais, who founded the newspaper L'Avenir, which appeared first in 1830s. And the slogan that they used was God and Liberty. The paper was aggressively democratic, and it demanded rights of local administration, enlarged suffrage, separation of church and state, universal freedom of conscience, freedom of education, freedom of press. So all this liberal, very liberal things, they actually were advocating for. And among Lamennais attracted several other people. Among other noted members of this movement were priest Lacordaire, Henri Lacordaire, and French noble Charles Montalembert. So these were the people. Eventually, the movement didn't, or rather this early collaboration of Lamennais, Lacordaire, Montalembert did not last. They decided that they will bring their
new radical ideas, which they thought were very beneficial to the Catholic Church. They decided to take them to Rome, where they were hoping the Pope will approve of them, because French hierarchy, church hierarchy, were very critical of these ideas. But the Pope wasn't supportive either. And after some tensions, this early collaboration disintegrated. So Lamennais went with Liberty, and Montalembert and Lacordaire went with the Catholic Church, but preserving this desire to modernize it. So it is at that moment in mid-1830s, where in this kind of state of disarray and disintegration, that members of the movement, Lacordaire and Montalembert, find their way to Svechina's salon. And what I say in my book is that essentially Svechina helps to reorganize, revitalize the movement. She provides this physical center, but also intellectual center for them, where they can come, gather again, regroup, debate the ideas, and attract new members. People were kind of gravitating to Svechina's salon to see these people, to talk to them. And her salon became the kind of a gathering place for them, and an important tool in revitalizing and restructuring, rebuilding the movement.
So Svechina experienced some of her own conflicts, right, in terms of her political affiliations and the way that she related to the liberal Catholic movement, as we call it now, particularly in terms of the way that she perceived legitimism in the monarchy, as well as the separation of church and state. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So Svechina was a monarchist, a legitimist in her views. But again, paradoxically, as she always succeeded kind of balancing in this intersection of various ideas, she also somehow succeeded in being a liberal. But basically, one of her main ideas was that, yes, monarchy is the best form of political, with best political system, best form of political rule, but the Pope is the ultimate head of the church, so not the monarch. So her approach to religion or kind of place of religion was a very liberal, basically kind of laissez-faire approach to religion. Just let it be. Religion, you know, should be separate from all of this, even though a benevolent monarch can do a lot of good for religion. But sometimes it could also suffocate. He could also suffocate religion, and in some cases use religion for his purposes. So it is best if kind of laissez-faire approach is used when it comes to religion. So which is seems like a kind of a reasonable attitude, and liberal Catholics felt like that she shared most of their ideas. She did have, however, some problems with certain ideas. For example, liberal Catholics, especially Montalembert, who was very close to Polish immigrants in Paris, and of course, Polish immigrants in Paris ended up there because of the crushed revolt against the Russian Empire. So he was very close to the Poles, especially Adam Mickiewicz. At some point, Montalembert had a romantic relationship with a Polish noblewoman. So he was very much supportive of Polish rights and nation's right for self-determination. Well, Svechina was very much against the independence of Poland. She was very much kind of against that. So they parted on some points. And in fact, she and Montalembert disagreed in it and parted their ways for a while until they finally mended their relationship. So there were some tensions. She was not consistent in her views. But some of the views she was able to reconcile, for example, science. She was always reading the most recent scientific articles, discoveries, was very interested in it, and she did not see any problems between reconciling science and theology. So, she was not fully consistent in her liberal Catholic views, but somehow was forgiven for that by liberal Catholics.
Mm-hmm. And what was the end of Svechina's life like? Did she end her life in Paris in this society, or did she return to St. Petersburg?
No, she. There was one moment where she didn't want to go to Russia. She didn't want to go back to Russia. She did have to make a short trip in kind of the end of 1830s to talk to, because at that point Nicholas called all of Russian subjects back to Russia. So she just could not. Her husband was ill. She was ill, and she was ill all her life. It's unclear to me, and I never quite get a clear picture of what her illness was. But she always suffered from great, which was always pain. So she went to Russia to ask Nicholas's permission to remain in Paris, and it was great that she had to use all of her multiple court connections. All her friends had to advocate on her behalf, and she did manage to get this permission. So she was great relief. She returned to Paris and stayed in Paris until her death. She died in 1957. This was basically kind of the end of the Salon year, so the end of her life corresponds to the end of the Salon year. Things were getting out of control. Catholics, liberal Catholics, were under attack. They really discredited themselves because they supported Louis Napoleon. And then there was a coup, and liberal Catholics were kind of implicated in it. There was they were splitting. Liberal Catholics were splitting, and you know where to place their political allegiances. Lacordaire went with the Republic. He became a Republican. He, you know, kind of supported the workers. Montalembert was very concerned that the revolution will take place, so he became more conservative. So there was a lot of kind of division within their own ranks, and there were divisions larger. They were attacked by everyone. And as I said, the political culture began to change too. There was a lot of partisanship. So Svetchina was suffering greatly, not only from her physical pains, but also from this emotional pain, seeing what was happening both to her friends, members of her salon, and also attacks that they were subjected to by others, by the press, conservative Catholic press. So it was her last years were a time of great physical and emotional anguish, where she was essentially, the salon was dying, and she was dying as well. And she died peacefully in her room in 1857, surrounded by friends. Lacordaire managed to see her. Then he left because she showed signs of recovery, but you know she died as soon as he left. There was a great, great kind of despair among her friends when she died. They were devastated, but immediately start working on commemorating and writing down her life. Yeah, so it was kind of a sad story of her death, because it was also a death of a salon culture, basically, in Paris at that time.
Now, you just mentioned the people immediately started writing about her life, right? And there's a sense in which your biography is sort of a metabiography, and that you talk about Svetchina's many biographers and the way that they, in some sense, almost painted a hagiography of her. So can you talk a little bit about sort of her legacy and how her biographers after her death portrayed her?
Right. So this is one of the things that I was kind of interested in when I started working on this, on her. I've discovered they were endless biographies. They all came out the first 20 years after her death, and they were translated into various languages. There was a lot of resonance. They were published and republished. There were collections of her letters, and it's all kind of was surprising to me because, yeah, she was an important salonnier, but there were a lot of important salonnier. For example, Madame Recamier was an important salonnier at that time, but I did not see a comparable number of biographies and volumes of her letters and diaries and reflections. So it was clear to me that there was some sort of need for this. And biography, is never really neutral, right? So there's biographies are written in response to certain needs of the society at the time, because biographies talk to us about people who were able to answer some questions that we're all struggling with. So I was very curious in why is that there's such an interest and need for her biography? What is it that she was able to do that these biographies now are trying to kind of show others how to do as well. So, and most of her biographies were written in a very hagiographical way. They followed the typical hagiographical tropes, how, oh, when she was a little girl, she already exhibited all the signs of, you know, the future saint. So essentially, to me, this was
an attempt to write a modern saint. And saints always serve as models, or they always provide models of behavior, right? So in Catholic Church, saints essentially, you know, Catholics are supposed to emulate their lives. So Svechina was written by her biographers as a modern saint. And so what they were trying to do is to use her life to show that it is possible to reconcile living in the world, not being a monk or a nun, being a worldly person, but reconcile deep faith, being a worldly person, but also all the modern things. The biographers insist that she was a liberal. Her mind was very scientific and very scholarly. She embraced liberal institutions, et cetera, et cetera. So essentially she became, just like her salon served as this gathering place for liberal Catholics, her biographers continued to perform the same role. She became a modern saint. She became a model of behavior. Look, you can do this too. You can be a saintly person, but you can also be a thoroughly modern person. So this was a kind of they were using her life to make the point that liberal Catholics maybe perhaps failed to make convincingly on a larger scale. So now Svechina became their spokesperson that, you know, you can be Catholic and you can be liberal. So that's how I see these biographies. And in a way, my biography was kind of my task in my biography was to undo this and to release the questions that were suppressed and packed into these old biographies, to release these questions and explore them and see how these biographers deal with these questions and what they're trying to get at.
Would you say to a certain extent your biography is sort of Sofia Svechina, the human being, as opposed to Sofia Svechina, the saint?
Yes. Even though, again, I think I get carried away slightly. I was too under the spell of Svechina. And as I said, one of my earlier reviewers said, that's a little too much admiration. I did try to be critical, and I suspected some of selfish motives here and there. Not all altruistic Svechina; she does it all for God. And so, I did try to kind of maybe question some of the things that her biographers were suggesting uncritically and unquestionably. But for me, her biography was. It's less of a biography of Svechina as I saw it, but it was a biography of her time. So I approach her life not in a linear way, such as let me recover this, even though it is linear because, we started when she's born, et cetera, kind of go to the end of her life. But the way I saw it, it's a narrative that's organized around questions that are really important and raise really important issues pertaining to Russian and French history. Why did people convert to Catholicism, for example? So, and then I use Svechina's life to answer this question. How did women build their authority and why in some cases this authority is successful, in some cases it's not? And then I use Svechina's life to approach this question. The place of liberal Catholicism in French politics. Look at Svechina. It's less about Svechina, I feel like, but it's more about that time and looking at how one person can really in her life get to all of the most important questions of that time.
So do you see Western Christian churches holding the same appeal for Russian intellectuals today?
Right. So I would say at the beginning of this interview, my own experience, the moment of this appeal of Catholic Church and Western Church was the strongest in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union in the 1990s, which is kind of a time similar to some degree to the period when Svechina and women from her circle were converting, which was in the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars, the French Revolution, which left this ideological vacuum. People were uncertain how to fill it, and they were kind of turning to religion. This is kind of what I saw happening in 1990s in Russia, where there was the same ideological vacuum. People were turning from rationalism and Marxism to spiritual things and not necessarily sure and certain where to turn. So some turned to Orthodoxy, some turned to Catholicism. there was interest in Protestantism, Buddhist sects, and so on and so on. So it's same impulses. In Catholicism at that time was seen as a religion of educated people. Orthodoxy implicated itself in collaboration with KGB, etc. So Catholicism still had this kind of ritualized religious appeal, but without some of the compromising aspects. But now I think the appeal of Catholicism is waning because of the rise of nationalism. It's again kind of very similar to what was happening after the Napoleonic Wars, where Russians suddenly became very Russian. So Russia sees itself in opposition to the West. So same thing as Nicholas I, opposition to the West. So there's more persecution against Catholics. And Catholics, they're still Russian Catholics. I have close connections to Catholic community in Russia. People still coming to Catholic Church, but it is does not have the same appeal. And it's became much more dangerous to become Catholic because the idea is, it's much more anti-Russian to be Catholic now than it was in 1990s when I was a member of that community. So, that's why. So Catholics are seen now as basically cultural and political traitors of Russia and Russian identity. That's why I see this project as a very important one, because it restores Catholicism to history of Russia. It shows that members of some of the greatest Russian families who, served Russia and Russian interests for centuries, they converted to Catholicism, not out of rejection of their Russianness, but in an attempt to make Russia part of Western legacy, kind of expanding their Russianness. And Svechina and others quite clearly and also explicitly argued that it was possible to be a Russian patriot and Catholic. So, I think it's important to give them voices and recognize who they were and look at their ideas and how they reconcile this tensions of Russianness and Catholicism. And they thought Catholicism is a universal religion. There is no national identity within it. So, there is place for a Russian within Catholicism, and Russian can be Catholic without losing any of his or her Russianness.
Thank you, Dr. Bakhmetova. It was wonderful talking to you today. Thank you for taking the time to discuss your book.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thank you.